Okay, we begin here on the top of Tzadik Gimel Amud Aleph, five lines down. The Gemara here shifts from what it was speaking about before, which are colloquialisms, where Rava was querying and asking, where do we know that from the Torah? Now the Gemara jumps tracks a little bit, and we have a new sugi. Amar Rav Chanan, Hamosa din al chavero, hu ne'anash tchila. Person who tries to get his friend into trouble, meaning asks for the friend to be punished, he gets punished first. Shneamar, because here's the proof. Atomer Sarai el Avraham chamasi alecha. Sarai says to Avraham, I'm upset at you about the situation with Hagar. Uchtiv v'yavo Avraham lispod de Sarah v'liv kota. And Sarah passes away significantly before Avraham Avinu. Sarah passes away at the age of 127, whereas Avraham Avinu passes away at the age of 175. So over here, Sarai, who is upset at Abraham and says to Abraham that I'm upset about what happened or transpired here with Hagar, the way that she's treating me because of the circumstances, and she presses on Abraham for that, the Gemara here indicates that she gets punished first. And the Gemara qualifies that and says, V'hani mile, dile dina ba'aro. That is, as long as there is a Beit Din to which she can approach and bring her case. In the time of Sarah, what type of Beit Din we're speaking about? Tosfot over here claims, B'mei Sarai, a Beit Din shel Shem Kayam. The Beit Din of Shem and Aver was still around at the time of Sarah, so she had a place to which to bring her complaint. So that's the first qualification of the Gemara, which is that calling out to Hashem is a last resort. One should only exercise that, calling out to Hashem, when there's no opportunity to deal with it, in the Dinei Haaretz, meaning dealing with it in a regular Beit Din. So if there is no way to get justice through the Beit Din, then the backup is to go to a Kodesh Baruch Hu and ask for justice. But going to a Kodesh Baruch Hu with justice then has ramifications or possible repercussions with regards to you asking a Kodesh Baruch Hu to intervene. Over here, the first part of the Gemara seems like it would be only in that situation where you had another opportunity, you didn't use it, but where you didn't have an opportunity to go to Beit Din, then maybe it would not be problematic. In the second half of the Gemara, it sounds like even that might be problematic. The main issue is that when you raise questions about another party, B'dinei Shamayim, if you're asking for them to intervene on your behalf and to punish the other individual, they're also going to take a quick look at your ledger, what exactly should be done, or whether you're deserving of this intervention on your behalf. And that's really borne out by the second part of the Gemara here, which is Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Oilo Litzoek, Yoter Min Anitzak. The one who calls out or cries out is in more trouble than the one who is called out about, the one who is being asked to be taken care of. Tanya Nami Yachi, we have a braita that supports this. Echad Atzoek V'Echad Anitzak B'Mashma. That when it comes to the psukim, the Tzoek and the Nitzak are included or subsumed under the pasuk. Now the main sugya that you find this by is actually Parshat Mishpatim. In Parshat Mishpatim, there it talks about when someone oppresses, whether it's the Atom or the Almana, and there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Vayat Yitzak Elai, when they call out to me. So there you have this ability, or there is an opening to call out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in order to bring justice to those that cannot get justice, because they're at the lower echelons of the social strata, and people don't take care of them, or people take advantage of them. And those are the Yitomim and the Almanot. And so over there it says, with Kodesh Baruch Hu, if they call out to me, then I will be their defender, and I will be the one who takes care of them. So here, the Gemara says that, Echad Atzawek V'Echad Nitzak V'Mashma, Rashi writes that the source for this is Ka'ashkechan B'Sarah, that we find this by Sarah, and that's the proof for the background to this, that by Sarah we see that case. Ella, Shemarim Latzoek, Yoter Min Nitzak. That the punishment comes both to the Tzoek and the Nitzak, just that the Tzoek gets punished first and then the Nitzak. And the reason being that in the Psukim, it writes in the plural, V'chara api V'ragdi Etchem. So it says, I will be angry, V'ragdi Etchem, and I will kill you. You in the plural sense. So who is the plural sense? Etchem. So Rashi, the way that the Gemara is using etchem here means both the tzoek, the one who called out, and the nitzak, the one who is being called out about. So that's where the Gemara is taking this, which is that similar to the case by Sarah, So too over here, there's a parallel sense that when someone tries to get the other person into trouble or punish the other person, that punishment befalls both of them, but comes first to the one who is soek. Now, Tosfot over here brings from the Sifrei, and the truth is that Rashi and Chumash also quotes the Sifrei, that the reads this Gemara in a slightly different way, and it seems that it might have been a different gear, so that's what Tosfot notes over here, which is that the way they read it in the Sifrei is that the punishment comes either way. No matter what happens, this person is going to get punished for oppressing the Yatom v'Almanah. The difference being that if the Almanah or the Yatom is Tzoei, calls out, Hashem comes quickly and punishes quickly. If they don't call out, then it'll take more time for the punishment to happen. But in both cases, the recipient of the punishment is the one who oppressed the Yatom v'Almanah. That's awake. The one who calls out is not punished in either of those cases. Hashem says, I'm going to punish them either way. So then the Sifrei asks, why do you need the tzaka? The tzaka just brings the punishment faster. So that's the way that the Sifrei explains it. And Tosfot says that, Shemaharim letzawek yotermi misha eno tzawek. That, not that the way that we have it here, that we're maharim letzawek yoter mina nitzak, that the tzawek gets it faster than the nitzak, but rather, maharim letzawek yoter misha eno tzawek. That it happens faster for the one who calls out than for the one who does not call out. And so there, that would have a very different meaning in this context, which is not similar to the case before. You can't read it like Rashi now, which says that, how do we know the fact that the oil that's awake, your term in Itzak, is not from Sarah? Because that is not what this is speaking about. What it's speaking about here is that oil that's awake, your term in Isha'en Otzawek. That's woe is to the one who is called out about versus the one who's not called out about, which then have the opposite meaning of the previous sugya. In the previous sugya, we said, oh, if you turn in your fellow Jew for punishment min hashamayim, then be careful because you're very likely to be punished first. Rabbi Yitzchak comes along and says that's not the case, that there is the tzawake, and eno tzawake does not cause problems for the tzawake, it just causes an expedience in punishing the nitzak. Now, it could be that Rabbi Yitzchak is following the previous Gemara that says, Hani Milei, the Beit Din D'Aro. That's only true when you have a Beit Din that will intervene. But when there is nobody intervene, for instance, in cases like an Yatom v'Almanah, who are being oppressed, and the problem is that nobody is intervening on their behalf. Since no one's intervening on their behalf, that's why you need to be Tzoweik. Then maybe you're justified in being Tzoweik, and there maybe a Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't punish the Tzoweik and only punishes the Nitzah. So that's a possible way to connect between the two of them. Or you could say that they are arguing about whether it's appropriate to call out to Kodesh Baruch Hu and ask for God to intervene when you don't have other protectors or other venues for expressing your frustration or your difficulties. So now, Gemara says, V'amar Rabbi Yitzchak l'olam alti kilat hejot kala be'enecha. While we're on the sugya of Sarah, we also want to say that when it comes to the curse of hejot, you shouldn't just dismiss the curse of Hedjot. Sure, Avimelech kelel et Sarah. Avimelech curses Sarah, v'nitkayim b'zarah. And it comes to fruition in her offspring. This expression of the Gemara is used in both directions, which is, Alti kilat Hedjot kalabeinecha, v'alti birkat Hedjot kalabeinecha. Basically, it means don't take lightly what people say. Sometimes what people say will come to fruition. And so don't be just dismissive of it, or that people have to be careful how they speak, because how they speak has impact. So how do we know this happened? Shnemar, v'nehu lecha ksut einayim. Again, it's not taking it in the literal sense. Ksut einayim means that Avimelech makes payment to Abraham, so that this will be, quote-unquote, a cover-up, showing that obviously nothing happened here, because I had to pay Abraham when I returned to you, to him. So it's clear here that nothing happened between us, because otherwise, why am I paying Avraham for what happened? The fact that I'm paying is a ksut einayim, meaning that's the cover-up, or that's the proof that nothing happened. Gemara here views ksut einayim being to really, literally, not a cover-up, but a loss of eyesight, or a loss of the ability to see. Now, the truth is, that's true. A cover-up, or something that causes people to see things in a different light, is, in essence, saying that they don't see things the way that it maybe looks on the surface. So the Gemara quotes ksut einayim literally, Amarla, hov, kasit mimeni velo gilit, since you covered up for me and didn't divulge to me, Shui Sheikh, that he's your husband. Garam Telay Atzara Zen, you caused me all this difficulty. You should have children who don't see, or things that are not obvious. And it even happened in her child, that his eyes dimmed and he wasn't able to see. So the Gemara sees that the Kilat Tejot of Avimelech, even though it was said and shouldn't be meaningful in the context, because they didn't necessarily act inappropriately given the circumstances that they were in, but nevertheless, because he gave that curse, it has manifestation. Maybe not early on in his life, but later on in his life, Yitzchak experiences this loss of eyesight or dimming of the eyes because of the fact that the Gemara connects it to the curse of Avimelech. So Amar Rav Yibo, lo'olam yehi adam min ha'nirdafim velo min ha'rodfim. Person should be always amongst those that are chaste and not the chasers. She'en lecha nirdaf ba'ofot yoter mitorim u'bnei yuna. There are no more chaste birds than the torim and the bnei yuna, the pigeons and the doves. V'chshirim ha'katuv l'gabei mizbeach. And they're the only birds that are allowed on the mizbeach. Now these birds, especially the yona or bnei yona, are vegetarians. They only eat vegetation. On the other hand, they are chased by many other predators, and so they are near dafim and not rodfim. And so because of that, they are chosen to be those on the mizbeach. Now, the Gemara doesn't explain any reason for that, doesn't give any background to that, but I think that the context in which it's written says the two points to be made by the Gemara over here. First of all, when things are difficult and things are going badly for an individual, and there are oppressors, and they reach out to Hashem, one has to be careful because of what we said before, which is that when you reach out to Hashem, Hashem will intervene, but that might come at a cost. That might have a cost to the person who is asking for the intervention to be punished as well, or even the possibility that they might be punished first, depending on the gears that you have in the Gemara. That's the first problem. The second problem that you face is it's better to be of the chaste than rather the chasers, is that God generally favors the underdog. Now, God favors the underdog because God favors the oppressed. And so here we're speaking on people that are oppressed. But there's also, I would say, something that's behind that, or the psychology behind that that's also true. It was mentioned in last week's Parsha. In last week's Parsha, Kodesh Baruch Hu says to Bnei Yisrael, I want you to know that the reason I chose you is not because lo merubchem, not because you are the largest and the most populous of nations, Ella, you're the mi'at, you're the smallest of nations, but I made a promise to your forefathers to accept you. Now, the reason behind that, Rashi notes it over there, is that the person who feels that they are chosen because they are the greatest, or they're most numerous, the most populous, then they get this idea that it's their righteousness which grants them the position of being the chaser, or being on top. Whenever you're an underdog and you succeed, the underdog never attributes that to themselves because by definition they are the underdog. And in being the underdog, you don't think of yourself as being more powerful. You think of yourself either being lucky, or the way that Kodesh Baruch Hu wants it to be is that you see that God intervened on your behalf. And so by being the underdog, you always recognize your successes as being attributed to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. When you're the bigger or the greater one, then you always think of Kochi Beotzim Yodi Asali Etachayel Hazeh, rather than attributing it to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And so I think that's what the Gemara means over here, and how it connects back to the previous sugya, is that it's always better to be the underdog or the oppressed, because you know, not because it's good to be oppressed, not because it's good to be chased, but rather when things go well in those circumstances, you will always attribute it to Hashem. And that's the most important aspect, rather than being the one who thinks that we're succeeding here because of the fact that we're greater, we're bigger, we're more populous, whatever it is. And again, it comes out of last week's parsha, I think is a good summation of what we've seen so far in the Gemara today. But we know, again, from Parshat Mishpatim as well, that Kodesh Baruch Hu is the defender of the oppressed, and he's the defender of the Yatom and the Almanah, those that don't have other defenders. And so Hashem will intercede on their behalf and will protect them. And that's what we say, that anybody who says Vayita Necha and Motzei Shabbat knows, and last week's Parsha was one of the examples that brought, that any time it talks about the greatness of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, right next to that it talks about how he takes care of the Atom V'Almanah. that he takes care of those that are downtrodden and those that are oppressed. And Hashem is the father of those that are oppressed. And that's really an important statement of the Gemara over here. So now we go back to the Mishnah. Omer et sima et eini, tie et yadi, blind, to knock out my eye, cut off my arm, shaber et ragli, break my leg, chayav, then the person's responsible. If they do it, the person's responsible for that. Now he says, amanat liftor, you can do it, and you're patur, chayav, you're still chayav. Meaning, no matter what he says, that does not exempt you from acting in this manner. So the Gemara says about this, Amalei Rav Asi bar Chama, L'Rova, there are two alternate girsos here. One is Rav, which is a little difficult. The other one is Rabba, which is probably a better girso over here, because Rava appears later on in the Gemara, and so that Rabba would make more sense. Maishna Reisha, Maishna Seifa. What's the difference between the Reisha of the Mishnah, which is the cases that I just quoted you, and the Seifa of the Mishnah, which says, Kraet Ksuti, Shaberet Kadi, rip my clothes, break my barrel, chayav. Then you're a chayav, just like you were in the case of the bodily harm. But then amanat liftor, on condition that you are patur, patur, then you are patur. What the Gemara wants to understand is, what is the difference between the case where it involves chavala, injury to the body of the individual, where he does not have a right to exempt you, versus the case of mamon, where you're damaging his property, when he says amanat liftor, that it goes through, and that is fine, and you are patur. So, from a most basic view of this, or the simplest view of this, the way you would read the Mishnah, is that there's a difference between chavala and nezek. Or, in essence, you are not the owner of your body. Since you're not the owner of your body, you're restricted from injuring yourself, but you're also restricted from allowing others to injure your body. And you can't waive that right, because you're not the owner of your body. With regards to your property, you are the owner of your property. There is a restriction, at least as we saw earlier, about the shchit, that one may not just wantonly destroy things for no reason, because there is an inyan about the shchit. But in the end, you are the owner of your property, and if you exempt someone from that destructive behavior, they will be patur. The Gemara will take variations of that root, slight variations of that root, some of them to determine or to get the cases where it's permitted to destroy things, because that makes the cases a little easier. But from a bigger picture standpoint, that seems to be the basic difference that's here. The Gemara wants to understand how or where does it derive from this difference. Amalei, so Rabba says back, Demresha, Lefishen Adam Mochela Roshei Avarim. People do not forgive about bodily harm. Even if they're saying, injure me, even if they're saying you'll be patur, they never really mean it. They will never forgive you for giving them that type of injury. Amalei, Vichy Adam Mochela Al Tzaro. So wait a minute, does someone give up on his tzar? People okay with other people causing them pain? V'detanyo, we have a braita. Hikani, p'tziani, no, hit me, injure me, amanat liftor, on condition to be patur, patur, then you are patur. So how can he waive his rights in terms of tzar and say you are exempt and that goes through? Yeah, when it comes to physical injury, there he's unable to waive that right. Ishtik. He was silent. Amar midesh me'elecha b'ha. So he says back to him, did you hear something about this? So amalei ochi amar rav sheshet mishum p'gam mishpacha. That there are outside variables that are to be considered here. Which is that when a person loses an arm or loses a leg, not only affects them, but affects their family as well. Now that could be from two perspectives. One is that they fall to their family to care for them. But also from the perspective of, now this is an oddity within the family, and then people are going to, especially in their day where these types of things played heavy roles in the social standing of the family, then there would also be a pagam mishpacha, which is that you don't only affect yourself, you affect others. And you can't waive those rights with regards to other people. You may be able to waive your own rights, but you can't waive your rights with regards to others. Therefore, in the issue of pain, pain is your own personal experience, doesn't have long-ranging, you know, impact, and so therefore you can suffer it and waive your right to payment. But then when it comes to things that are visibly changed about the person, meaning that injuries that are on the Rosh Varim, over there you cannot waive that right, you cannot exempt other people, not because you couldn't exempt them, but because you can't speak on behalf of your other family members or the rest of the family, you can't do that. The assumption here is that the pain stands independent of any of those other items, meaning that if the pain somehow inhibits your ability to perform, then there's another factor here, nezek or shevet, there's other factors involved. What we're talking about here is pain that does not have an outcome which is detrimental in any other factor besides the pain. Right, the previous mission discussed that the difference between boshet and other things is boshet is a payment that does not involve loss, whereas nezek is a payment that involves loss. Right, itmar, Rabbi Yoshi amar mishum pegam mishpacha. So Roshi says a similar thing, that bishum pegam mishpacha, meaning that seconding what we saw from Rabbi Sheshet. Rova amar mishum she'en adam mochel al roshei avarim shelo. Rava goes back seemingly to the first statement of Rabba and says, no, it's Mishum She'en Adam Ochel Roshei Avarim Shelo. That's why those that favor the Girsa before, that it's Rabba, because over here you have a statement of Rava, otherwise he's just repeating what he said before. So now, what do you do with the fact that we had that Braita that said you can wave by Tsar? So Rashi explains over here now that based on Ubraita Lo Tikshe Dal Tsaro Mochel Adam. He says the Braita is not a question because people are mochel on the Tsar. Meaning that he makes this distinction that Tsar, people are mochel on, whereas it coming to injury or Roshei Avarim, they don't forgive. So the same distinction that is drawn, at least at the Pegam Mishpacha level, that is being Tsar versus Chavala, Rova makes that same distinction at the personal level, which is somebody will waive Tsar, but they won't waive the Chavala or the loss of a limb. And so he sees that's just a difference in the nature of human beings or the nature of the way people conduct themselves. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Yeshein Shu Kalav, Veshlav Shu Kain. The way Rashi reads this, this is another way to deal with the Mishnah. It's another answer, but the answer is somewhat interesting because it takes away all the distinctions that we've made until now. Which is Rabbi Yochanan basically says, according to Rashi, it depends on the answer of the individual as to whether they're really saying yes or no. The intonation of how they answer tells you whether they're making a statement or whether they're really saying something sarcastically or in a rhetorical manner. So the person, for instance, they make a statement, come, go ahead. And the person says, go ahead and cut off my arm. So the party who is being asked to do this says, I'm an atliftor. Am I going to be patur if I do this? And then the original party says back to him, yes. How that yes is responded, it will determine. If he makes a statement of yes as a statement, then yes, you'd be patur. If he says, yeah, meaning like as if it was, what do you mean? You think I'm going to let you be patur for this? No way. Then the yes means no. And so Rashi basically reads Rabbi Yochanan saying that sometimes yes means no, and sometimes no means yes. And the way that you determine it is on the intonation of the response. Whether they're saying it, again, sarcastically or rhetorically, you'll know as to whether they mean it literally when they make it as a statement versus the other versions where they really mean the opposite of what they are saying. That means two things. First of all, if the party themselves says the whole thing, it's clear you are patur. If the original party says, you know, cut off my arm and you'll be patur, then there's no question what they're saying because they're making a statement and there they definitely would be patur. The second thing is that our Mishnah differentiates between Gufo and Mimono. According to Rashi, no such distinction exists. The distinction exists in the response of the party, not whether it's about Gufo or about Mimono. It all has to do with how he answers. So then why did the Mishnah differentiate between Gufo and Mimono? Rashi says, Orche de Milta Nokat, de Machalin Shem Mumune Tfemi Gufe. That's just normal way that people act. People are more likely to forgive when it comes to their property than they are to chavala of their goof. But ain't ochanami, if you said it in as a no or sarcastically when he was talking about mamon, the person would be chayav. And if you said yes, statement-wise, by gufo, the person would be patur. And that's the way Rashi reads this answer of Rabbi Yochanan as an alternate way to explain the Mishnah or the distinction in the Mishnah. In essence, he wipes out the entire distinction and simply says that it has to do with the nature of the response that's given over here. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tosafot is uncomfortable reading it that way because then in the end, you have no differentiation between Gufom and Mono, which is the nature of the whole question. Now true, sometimes to answer the question, you take away the question. That's what Rabbi Yochanan's doing. He's taking away the question completely. But he says, V'dochaku. So the explanation of Rashi is very difficult. Elanir lefaresh, the nizke Gufo, Afilo Marlehain, Shadomer Kumer bin Ichuta, Bistama bitmiya kamar. Tosfot says, no, that what the Rabbi Yochanan is establishing is the default. And he's saying here that even if a person makes a statement by the case of Gufo, and the person says, will I be patur if I do this? And the other person says, yes, of course you'll be patur. He doesn't really mean it. No matter how he answers, he should be answering in a sarcastic manner, and we attribute that sarcasm, no matter, even if he makes it as a statement, we assume even yeses by Gufo mean no. That a person has to know, even when you say yes, it means no by Gufo. And the other way around is true by Mimono. That if the person tells you to go destroy their property, and then you say, I'm an atliftor, and you say, am I going to be patur? And the guy says, no. Over there, mistama, the no means not no as a statement, but no as a rhetorical question or a sarcasm, and the no really means yes. And so therefore, what Rabbi Yochanan is suggesting over here is that by gufo, whether he says yes or no, it means no. By mimono, whether he says yes or no, it means yes. That you will always be patur by mimono, and you will always be chayab by gufo, because that is the nature of people. People by mimono will forgive, by gufo they won't forgive. And so therefore we're going to attribute their statements, no matter how they say it or what intonation they use, it will always be yes by the case of mimono, and no by the case of gufo. In that way, then Rabbi Yochanan could be explaining the Mishnah, or could be just an independent statement here, explaining how to view people's statements here, yeses and noes, not necessarily explaining the difference between gufo and mimono, and that is because Tosva does say that there is an alternate girsa over here, the ish svarim shekatuv ben ketzad, velo garsinan le. And there are some svarim that say how, and so therefore that would help you in explaining this, or continuing the statement of Rabbi Yochanan. In the Mishnah, correct, suti shaber kadi chayav, ketzad, how does that work? I'm not liftor, patur. That if he says it's patur, you will be patur. Meaning that, how does that work? That works that no matter what, you're always patur in those cases. If you ask them, no matter what he answers, you're going to be patur. Right, so now the Gemara says, Tanya Nami Yochi, we have a braita that supports this view of Rabbi Yochanan. Hitani pitziani, I'm not liftor. So he says, hit me, you know, injure me. I'm not liftor. Then is the response of the other party. Am I going to be patur? Vamalo, hey. He says, yes. Hari yesh hain shu kelav. There is sometimes a hain that is like a lav. Krat suti. I'm not liftor. Again, he answers him, is I'm going to be patur? Vamalo lav. He says, no. Hari lav shu kain. Sometimes no means yes. So again, according to Rashi, the yes and the no over here, Rashi means that the yes, if it's intonated in a way that indicates that it's not really a yes, then you will be chayav. And the no, if it's intonated in a way that is also not a statement, then you will be patur. According to Balei Tosafot, by definition, the yes, by the case of the gufo, means no. And then by definition, the no, by the case of mimono, means yes. Because the fact that he asked you already to damage it, already includes within that, or subsumed in that, is a tour or an automatic exemption, because otherwise, why did he bother to ask you to do this? Because of that, we will assume that even if he says no, he really means yes in that case. Shaberet kadi krat suti chayav. He says, break my utensil, rip my clothing, you are chayav. Riminhu. Lishmor velo la'abed. Lishmor velo likroa. Lishmor velo la'chalek da'aniim. So if you make someone into a shomer, that's the way that is expressed in the Torah, ki yitein, right? A person gives, gives to his friend to watch something. The Gemara here says that you have to give it over to watch. In order for the individual to be responsible for the item that he takes, it has to be given in a manner that you're being mafkidit, that you are depositing it with him in order for him to watch it. Now then, if you're giving it to him for other reasons, first of all, le'abed, to destroy it, or to rip it up, or to distribute it to the aniyim, that individual will not be responsible for the item because he's not made into a guardian of the object in that case. Right, so Rashi addresses your issue and says that the case here is not literally where he says, I'm giving it to you to break, I'm giving it to rip, but rather he's saying that he's telling him this because he's basically, what the Gemara is saying is that you're not chayav in pshia. Unless you establish a relationship of shmirah, then you're not chayav for the pshia that happens. And so what the Breita is saying here is not, he gave it to him to the abed, he gave it to him likroa, but rather, since he didn't give it to him as a shomer, then he doesn't stand or doesn't take on the responsibilities of a shomer. In that case, if it was ripped or if it was lost, he's not responsible for it. Since there was no relationship established with shmirah, if something happens, you're not responsible. Now that seems to go against our Mishnah, because in the Mishnah where he gives instructions to destroy it, there you're still chayav. Over here, we didn't give explicit instructions to destroy it, so it didn't make you into a shomer. Yet when you then lose it, rip it, or destroy it, you are patur. So that seems to be a stira to the Mishnah. In one case, we're saying you're obligated, even in a case where they explicitly tell you to do it, you're chayav. And in the Braita, where they don't explicitly tell you to do it, and you do it, then you're a patur. That seems to be a stira. So Amravuna lokasha, hada ateliyade, hada lo ateliyade. It's a question of whether it reached his hand or didn't reach his hand. The way that Rashi explains it over here is, kara biyadayim chayav. If it reached his hands and he rips it up, he's chayav. That as soon as it's in your hands and you are now a guardian of this object, if you rip it up biyadayim, you're going to be chayav. On the other hand, if it never reached your possession and then you rip it up, then you're going to be patur. The guy said, come and rip it up, just to go over there and you rip it up without it ever coming into your possession. I mean, that he never handed it to you in any other manner except for the fact that he says rip it up and you go right away and rip it up. And then if he hands it over to you to watch or do something with it and then you rip it up via dime afterwards, there you're going to be chayav. That's a distinction that Ravuna makes. The Gemara is going to say, Amalei Rabba, lishmor da ati liyadei mashma. That distinction doesn't seem to hold water because the case of the Braita is a case where he was going to be a shomer. The case of a shomer is clearly a case where you expect it goes to his hand. He's actually in possession of the item. And that's the case where you're saying you are a patur. The Braita says you are patur when it reaches your hand and you rip it up. So it sounds actually the opposite of what you're saying, Rav Huna, that when you're in possession of it, you are patur. Elamah Rabba, Rabba says, no, this is the distinction to make. Havaha da'atul yadeh. Both of the cases where it reached his hand. Velo kasha, and that's not a question. Had ata yadei b'torat shmira. Had ata yadei b'torat kriya. Does it reach his hands b'torat shmira? Meaning that mikara, he established him as a shomer, and then afterwards says to him, go ahead and rip it up. So there, if he rips it up, he's going to be chayav, unless he gets the specific acquiescence of the party, say, I'm not liftor, and then it works. But in the case where it's handed over, again, b'torat kriya, it's handed over to be ripped. Now again, doesn't mean that it necessarily is handed over to be ripped. That's the way the Baal Tosfot explained over here. But simply it was handed over without any establishment of a relationship of Shmirah. And then he tells you to rip it up. There, you're not going to be responsible for ripping it up because he told you to rip it up. And you don't need that extra statement of exemption. So what happens is that if it comes to your possession, you are responsible for the item. Now, as a shomer, you're responsible for everything. When you're not a shomer, you're not responsible for the pshia. Now, if the person comes in and tells you to rip it up, the owner himself tells you to rip it up, in the case where you're not a shomer, you don't owe him any obligation towards him in watching the item, then you rip it up, you did what he said, then you're fine, you're patur, because you never established a position as being a shomer. If he tells you to rip it, you do whatever he tells you to do. The other hand, in the case where he made you into a shomer, and then he comes and says, rip it up, over there you have to double check with him. Because he already established you as a shomer, which makes you responsible for the item. Now when he comes along and says, rip it up, you have an additional responsibility to ensure nothing goes wrong with the item if you rip it up. So then you have to double check with him and say, I'm not liftor. That's the way that Rabba explains the difference in the cases over here to explain why in some cases you will be patur, in some cases you will be chayav. Now, here again, we explain the Gemara according to Rashi. What's interesting here is that Tosafot gives, Ari gives a light, slightly different explanation, which is a little more nuanced in the explanation, and maybe makes it a little easier to understand the Gemara along here, which is the Ri Mifaresh, Dakimitro, Lishmor Veloli Kroa. What does it mean that you gave it to watch, not rip it up? Perish Natan Lolishmor, Velo Yishara, Loli Kroa, Velola Abeid. If he didn't tell him to do anything, as Chayav Bechol Din Shomer. Then he becomes a full-fledged Shomer. Avam Yishara Li Kroa Abeid, Im Yirtze, Inalav Din Shomer, Litchayev Bukulam. Then you don't become a shomer, but meshe kablo lishmor. Kevin shnotein lo rishot gam litkroa ul abeid im yirtzev, because he gives him permission to rip it up. The way the Bari explains it is that the way that the object is given to you has impact on the obligations that devolve upon you. If a person simply hands you an item and doesn't make any qualification about ripping it or not ripping it, you become a shomer. Once you become a shomer, you're responsible for the item in a full way. If a person hands over an item and says to you, you can rip it up, you can lose it, you can do whatever you want with it, then the truth is he's not necessarily allowing you to do whatever you want with it. He's simply telling you that you're not a shomer. He's saying to you, listen, I'm telling you that don't worry about being a shomer here because I'm not going to hold you responsible if something goes wrong. That's what he's telling him up front. He's not telling him to rip it up. He's not telling him to lose it. He's simply telling him, if something happens, I don't want you to worry because I'm not going to make you... That relationship is determined by how he expressed it to you up front. And that expression tells you whether you're a shomer or not a shomer. It does what says that more explicitly over here. Hadi ata yade perish matznita shenatan liyado. Our Mishnah is a case where he gave it into his hand. Barmalei, shmor, watch it. Vim tirtze likroa aser kitzoncha. If you want to rip it up, do whatever you want. Kevin shechasa lachafetz shalomalei karo ad shebayi liyado. Since he doesn't tell him to rip it up until it reached his hand, shifkido etzlo tzchila mashutein lo lishut likaro b'siyum dvarav inu merkein k'day lefatro. He's trying to convince him that don't worry about it so much. Say, don't worry so much, I'm not going to be so makpid on you. But it does not mean that he's giving you permission to rip it up. On the other hand, by the Braita, where when he hands it over to him, he hands it over his hand, he says, you can watch it for me, you can rip it up, you can do whatever you want. That already establishes a relationship which says there's no shmirah here, there's no shomer here. And if you want to rip it up, he's definitely telling him, go ahead and rip it up, because the relationship was never established yet. And so that's the key for the Balei Tosafot, the way that the Rizal is explaining it, has to do with the nature of the relationship. If there's a relationship of a shomer already, whatever he says after that, you can't take literally. That's the way Rabbah is explaining it. In the first section, we're saying how the relationship is established. When Rabbah says everything reached them, so then what's the difference between the cases? In the first case, it reached them as a shomer first. That means that the statement afterwards about don't worry about ripping it up, that's just to make him feel better, to ease his mind about the fact that I'm not going to be so strict with you if something happens. Doesn't mean that you're patur, doesn't mean that I'm releasing you of anything, I'm just trying to calm you down. Then if I'm giving you the item, and that's the establishment of the relationship, you know, take it and watch it, take it and rip it, that means we never establish a relationship of shmirah. Since we never establish a relationship of shmirah, if you rip it up now, then you can take my words literally. I'm not telling you watch it and then trying to calm you down. I told you up front you can rip it up. If I do that up front already, then there's no relationship and there's no responsibility and you can rip it up because you can take him literally at face value. So that's the way Tosafot explains it slightly differently than Rashi, which is it's all about the establishment of whether you are or not a shomer over here. That's what the determining means, that his expression tells you whether you are a shomer or not a shomer. The nature of a shomer is to watch. Whereas the nature of someone who's not a shomer doesn't have any of those responsibilities. Rashi just simply says that the expression itself is a question of whether it expresses your right to do something or not to do something. Depends on how you did it. Did he give it to him as a shomer or did he give it to him as a koreya? Not literally as a koreya, but without responsibility. So Rashi says it's in the expression itself. Are you a shomer or not a shomer? Tosafot says no, the way you express the responsibilities will determine whether you are a shomer or not a shomer over here. All right, now, Gemara brings a case. How Arnaka did Staka, the Ata the Pumpadita, there was this money pouch of Staka that ended up in Pumpadita. Afkada Rav Yosef Gabi Ahu Gabra. Rav Yosef deposited it with this individual. Pasha Ba. That person did not watch it properly. Atuba Ganve Ganvua. The thieves came along and stole it from him. Chayve Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef made him responsible to pay it back. Samarle Abaye. Abaye quotes the Braita that we just quoted before. Vatanya Lishmor. Velo Lechalek Daniim. If you give it over to him to be a shomer, that's one thing. But if you give it over to him to distribute to the aniim, then there is no responsibility over here. The reason being, Rashi suggests over here, is because you didn't give it to him as a shomer, so he's not a shomer. In terms of the aniim, who would be then the claimants, the aniim don't have a claim because they are a class of individuals, but no single ani has a right of claim over here. And since there's no quote-unquote class action suit that you can be brought in by half of the aniim, there is no claimant. That's what Rashi says the failure is over here in terms of the chalek, the aniim. So amalei, aniye de pumpadita, mikatz kayetz lehu v'lishmorhu. That when it comes to the aniim of pumpadita, they get a fixed stipend or a fixed allowance every week. And therefore they do have a claim on the money because they have an exact amount that they will receive. And then since they know that amount, they can come as claimants against this individual. So the way Rashi is learning it is that normally when you have it, l'chalek l'aniim, there is no claimant that can come against the shomer. Under this case, there is a claimant because the aniyim know what they're going to receive, and therefore they can make a specific claim against the individual. Right, but or they know the amount. This is the money that was going to be distributed. They know how much it is that they're going to get, and therefore they have a real claim against the individual. And that's why Rav Yosef obligated him to pay in that case, because there are claimants in that case. This goes back to what we saw earlier in the Masechta as well, as to whether maybe it's not called Gezel, or possibly it's not called Gezel when there is no claimant. But again, when there is a claimant, and they can make a definitive claim, then there's a problem of Gezelah, or a problem of a Pshia over here, and then he has to pay it back. He's responsible for the monies. Okay, with that we end Perek HaChovel, Hadron Alach HaChovel. Okay, now the Gemara begins the final two prokim of the Masechta. As we said in our introduction to the second half of the Masechta, that this really deals with Adam, and the Adam HaMazik. So we had before the first prokim dealt with Gneva. Then we dealt with HaChovel, which is the Adam HaMazik himself. And the latter two prokim deal with Gzela, which is the other aspect of human causing of damage through not necessarily the physical damage, but through the means of theft that a person causes damage. So here we have the Mishnah. It says, a Gozel Yitzim Asan Kelim, someone who steals wood and makes them into utensils. Tzemer, wool, Asan Bigadir, makes them into clothing. Mishalim Kishata Gzela, he pays based on the time of the theft. And he does not have to return the items that he made. As Rashi says over here, the cannabis shinui, that he's koneh them with the shinui that happens over here. And therefore, once he's koneh them, he has to pay at the time of the theft, not the object that he has now, because he can't return the object that he stole. The object that he stole is no longer in existence. There is a new object over here. That new object, he does not have to return, because that's not the object that he stole. So instead, he pays, in lieu of the object, he pays the value of what he stole, which is at the time that he stole it. Gazal para mi'uberet ve'yalda, steals a pregnant cow and it gives birth. Rachel ti'una, or a ewe that is full of wool, v'gazaza, and then he sheared it, mishalem d'mei para omedet le'leit, d'mei rachel omedet li'gazez. He pays for the amount of a para that is ready to give birth, or d'mei rachel that is ready to be sheared. Over here it's not clear what he gives back. Because we know that post the activity, meaning that after the para gives birth, the para is still here. After the Rachel is sheared, the Rachel is still, the ewe is still there. So what is the Mishnah saying? Is the Mishnah saying that you pay back the para, and then on top of that you have to pay the amount that it would have been had the para been pregnant? Do you return the Rachel, and then on top of that you pay for a Rachel that is already loaded with its shearings? And from Rashi, it sounds like va'otev shesheve akshav avlad va'gizay shalyoter shalohu the kanane will be shinoi. Rashi seems to mean that you kone it b'shinoi, that the additional value that it has with the vlad now or the gizah, that becomes yours and you kone b'shinoi. Or is the Mishnah saying over here that in that case mishalem kishata gzela, which means that this animal, you keep the para, you keep the ewe. You don't have to pay back a full-fledged para that was pregnant, or a ewe that was carrying its wool. So now that you return them plus, but you return the monetary value, and that there is no obligation to return the core item. Questionable here, the Mishnah is not clear about how you have to pay it back. This is the principle. Kol ha-gazlanim mishlamim kishat ha-gzela. All thieves pay kishat ha-gzela. So now the Gemara says, Amrei, it seems, the way that our Mishnah reads, it seems that san kelim, if they're wood and he makes them into utensils, in, then it is kishat gzela. Shipan, lo. If he simply smooths them out, if he sands them down, that would not be a change in the item and he'd return them as they are to the original owner. Gazal, tsemer. If he steals wool, asan begadim, which is our Mishnah says, he made him to clothing, in, then he doesn't have to return them, he makes the monetary payment. Libnan, lo. But if he simply whitened them, he cleaned them, then that would not be considered a shinoi, and he'd have to give it back. Biraminu, is that really true? We have a braita that says, gazal itzim vishipan, he stole wood, and then he sanded it down, he smoothed it out. Avanim visititan, he stole stones, and he chiseled them out. Tzemer v'libnan, he stole wool, and he whitened them. Pishtan, he stole flax, v'nikeo, and then he cleaned it. Mishalem kishat ha-gzela, he pays kishat ha-gzela, which means that all of these are considered to be a shinoi. So why does our Mishnah only give the example of extreme changes like kelim and like bigadim, whereas the Braita gives examples where even lighter forms of change are considered to be a shinoi? As Baliat Tosafot are going to point out in a second, it's only considered to be a shinoi if two things happen over here. One is that there's a maaseh, you have to do an action. Number two is the shinoi hashem. And that will play out here, which is Amar Abaye, Tana didan tani shinoi de Rabbanan. Our Tana talked about shinoiim that are only rabbinic in nature. Dehadra, because they go back. They can be reversed. V'choshkein shinoi d'oraita. Certainly, if it was a shinoi d'oraita, which is an irreversible shinoi. Eitzim v'asan kelim. The case of eitzim v'asan kelim, beitzim mishupim. They're already smoothed out. They're already sanded down pieces of wood. Mainu nisarim, they're boards. The shinoi d'hadar b'riyato. It is a change that can be taken back to its original position. So when he puts together the utensil, whatever it is, with these boards or these pieces of wood, he doesn't change the wood. He uses the wood as it is and makes them into utensils. So he can simply dismantle the wood and you would have the wood back to its original state. So that's not called a shinoi. Midoraita. Minatora, that's not a shinoi. Midorabanan, that's already considered a shinoi. We'll see later on in the Gemara. Tomorrow's daf, that's because of Takanat HaShavim. In order to help the Gazlan want to give it back and pay it back, he doesn't have to take all his work or all his effort and dismantle it. So therefore we allow him to pay it back. So our Mishnah is saying in a case where there's not an extreme shinoi, where it's reversible, the shinoi, you still can pay kashat ha-gzeila, but it's only a rabbinic intervention in the case. Because there you can take it apart. Semer vasan bigadim, the same thing with wool that's made into clothing, but semer tavui. It's semer that's already been spun into threads. The shinoi da'ad al-briyato, because then you can just take out the threads and you'll have the threads back. Dibai satelite, because you can just unwind it. Once again, shinoi d'oraita would certainly be that way. V'tana bara, the outside tana, I mean the braita, shinoi d'oraita tani. He's talking about shinoi d'oraita. Shinoi d'oraita, vel shinoi d'rabanan lo tani. He's not talking about shinoi d'rabanan. He's talking about irreversible changes to the item. So if you sand down the wood, if you make the wood into a beam, then you've changed the wood to an irreversible thing. You can't put the sawdust back on it. If you take wool and you clean it, you dye it white, meaning that you've cleaned it, that's irreversible. You can't take it back from that whitening and put it back where it was before. Those are irreversible changes. Those irreversible changes are shinoi d'oraita. They're mina Torah. You would pay back money and not the item itself. So the Braita is speaking about the d'oraita level where the gazlan pays money. Kashat ha-gzeila does not return the actual object. Our Mishnah is not that cases where midoraita you would have returned the object. But the Rabbanan intervened in those cases and said that's already considered enough of a shinoi that you do not have to return the object. And the Rabbanan intervened not because midoraita that you didn't have to pay it back. But you do have to pay it back midoraita. But the Rabbanan allowed you an exemption in this case because takanat ha-shavim, which again we'll see on tomorrow's daf. That is Abaye's explanation for the difference between the Braita and the Mishnah. Ravashi Amar, Ravashi gives an alternative view as to what the answer is. Tana didan, nami shinui d'oraita k'tani. Our Mishnah is also talking about shinuim that are d'oraita. Itzin vasan kelim. When it's talking about wood that's made into utensil, it's talking about buchane. It's talking about a pestle or a certain sort of club. I mean that you're shaping the wood. You're not simply putting the wood pieces together to make something. You're actually carving or shaping the wood to the point where it has a different shape. Not only a different shape, you're doing a maaseh, it has a different name to it now. It's no longer called wood, it's called a pestle now, not the wood that you had before. Da'inu shipan, which is the equivalent of shaving the wood down or smoothing out the beams and making it into a beam. Tzemer vasan bigadim, the wool and making it into a beged is the case of namte. Namte is felt, where you press the wool down. And again, da'inu shinoi de lo hadar. That's an irreversible type of shinoi, and which is similar to what the Braita suggested as an irreversible type of shinoi, which is libun, which is the whitening of the tzemer. So what Ravashi does is says that our Mishnah and our Braita are both talking about shinoim d'oraita. They're talking about real changes in the item that are shinoi maiseh, that also has a shinoi hashem, which is recognized by the Torah as being a shinoi, and you would pay back the money and not return the object. It just, they express it differently. Our Mishnah was talking about kelim, is really talking about kelim that are the equivalent of being shipan, of sanding them down or making a change that is irreversible. And the same thing with semer vasan bigadim. So now the Gemara challenges this idea of libun mi avi shinui. Is libun really a shinui? Verminu lo yispik litno lo ad shitzva o patur. This is not even the case of reshita geiz. Reshita geiz is the first of your shearings you have to give to the kohen. Now, once you've sheared the animal, you have to collect a certain amount or minimum amount in order to be chayav to give it to the kohen. That's number one. Number two is, you have to give it to the kohen as wool before it's changed its form. If it's changed its form already, then you don't no longer have to give it to the kohen. So we're going to see that. The first braita here says, if he didn't have a chance to give it to him, achitzavo, before he dyed the wool, patur, he no longer has to give it. As Rashi notes over here, that is because, delav gezel gamurhu. It's not full-fledged gezel, delomata liyode, because it never reached the kohen himself. Since it never reached the kohen himself, and the kohen, as an individual, has no claim here. It's only the class of kohenim that have a claim here. And that's what we spoke about Rashi in the previous Samud, that maybe when there's no claimant, there's no gezel. Rashi only explains it as it's not called gezel gamur. It's only a partial gezel. So here Rashi acknowledges that there might be a problem, even though it may not be full-fledged gezel. But since it's been dyed at this point, then you are patur from giving the reshita geiz. Livno, velotzibo. If he whitened it, he cleaned it, but he did not dye it, chayav. In that case, he is chayav to give it, which shows you that that's not considered to be a change. Whitening it or cleaning it is not a sufficient change to be that you're patur from giving the reshita geiz. So that's a stira to the braita that we brought before, which says that livno is a type of shinoi. So Amar Abayi lo kasha, ha Rabbi Shimon ha Rabbanan. So Abayi solves the problem and says that's Rabbi Shimon and that's Rabbanan. Tatanya, gazzo, tivao, ve'argo, ein mitzteref. So again, this is not about reshita geiz, what I said before, that you have to have a minimum shi'ur in order to give reshita geiz. That minimum shi'ur is you need five animals, five rechelot, and they have to be toein mana vechetzi. Each one of them has to have 150 zuz worth of wool. When you combine all of them together, that obligates you to give the reshita geiz. If after each animal you sheared, you do something to the wool, it's not mitzarev with the other animals. And that's what the bright is speaking about. Gizazo, he sheared it to va'o, and then he spun it, va'argo, and then he weaved it, ein mitzarev. They don't connect. Livno, if he cleans it, he whitens it, Rabbi Shimon Omer, ein mitzarev. Rabbi Shimon says there's no tziruf, chamim omer, mitzarev. And so here you have a machlok between Rabbi Shimon and Chachamim as to what whitening or cleaning it does. According to Rabbi Shimon, that is enough of a shinoi that it no longer joins together with the other wool that you shear for the other animals to make you chayav in reshita geiz. According to Chachamim, it's not a sufficient shinoi, therefore you're not going to be patur, and it will be mitzaref with the other wool. So that's what Abayi says, the different braitot are authored by different individuals. There are Rabbanon who say that libun is not a shinoi. They'll be the author of that previous braita with reshita geiz. The braita before that talked about libun being a shinoi for kinyan, for the gazlan, that'll be according to Rabbi Shimon, who says that libun is a sufficient type of shinoi. Rabba Amar, Rabba disagrees with the bai and says, ha v'ha Rabbi Shimon. They are both authored by Rabbi Shimon, the lokasha. Ha dinaftse nefutse, ha disarke seruke. It depends how he went about doing this whitening. So it's both according to Rabbi Shimon who says that libun is a change, but libun comes in different forms. As Rashi explains over here, that if he does it nefitza according to Rashi is biyad. It's when you do it by hand. You clean it by pulling your hand through it or running your fingers through it. Seruke b'masreik is with a comb, that you combed it through, you used a special comb. So the cleaning or the untangling of it and the whitening of it with a comb, that is a significant type of shinoi. By hand, that is not a significant enough shinoi, and that could be reversed, even within the shita of Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Chiya b'Avin Amar, Rabbi Chiya b'Avin offers another alternative, which is, had the chavrei chavurei, this is that he whitened it, had the chavrei chivruei. Now again, as Rashi explains over here, chavrei chivruei means begafrit. He used sulfur, l'itla ben yafeh. He used the sulfur to wash it down, which makes it super white. So chavrei chavurei is either that he just simply combed it, or that he whitened it by washing it, but he didn't use any chemical in the mixture. The case of Kavrei Kavurei is that he used a chemical in the mixture. So therefore, the difference, and seemingly, according to the simplest way to read it, the way Rashi seems to read it, is that this is another distinction within Rabbi Shimon Shita. Within Rabbi Shimon Shita, you could differentiate between whitening, that is simply just washing it,
That is not considered to be a shinoi. For it says whitening a libum that involves a sulfur and a chemical reaction, which is a whitening that is irreversible, and something that's considered to be a shinoi. If you look in the Balei Tosafot, the Balei Tosafot do not want to see this all within Rabbi Shimon, but even see this within the Shita of the Chachamim. He says, Ha dechavrei chavuri ha dechavrei kavurei. V'tarvayu aliba dekuliyama. Tosafot says that these are both according to everyone. Dechavrei chavurei afilu Rabbi Shimon lo avi shinoi. That just washing according to Rabbi Shimon is not a shinoi. V'kavrei kavurei afilu Rabbanan avi shinoi. And kavrei kavurei, even if the Rabbanan is considered to be a shinoi. So then where's their machloket? So according to the Tosafot, their machloket has to be about the combing. V'ashta, benefutzei v'chivurei l'kuli yama lo avishinoi. According to this, where they were explaining it, nafats and chivarei, according to everyone, is not a shinoi. Ubikavrei, according to kavrei, l'kuli yama avishinoi. Ubisiruk plige, and they argue in siruk. The way that Tosafot's learning it is that when you either comb it by hand, or you wash it, everybody says that's not a shinoi. If you do it through a chemical reaction, everybody agrees that is a shinoi. The question is when you comb it with a utensil. There, Rabbi Shimon says that is a shinoi, and the Chachamim say it's not a shinoi. That'll be the only place there's a machloket. But according to the Tosafot, then, all the brayta that we said here can be authored by everyone, because everyone can come up a case where libun is a shinoi, and a case where libun is not a shinoi. Right, so now the Gemara continues and says, wait a minute. Hashto yesh lomar tseva the Rabbi Shimon lo avi shinoi libo and avi shinoi. According to Rabbi Shimon, who says that coloring it, dyeing it, is not considered a shinoi, he's going to say that libun is a shinoi. How can you say that, Tanya? Because that's rishon. Again, he sheared each animal one by one vitzivao, and then he dyes it rishon utivao. First one first, and then he spins it. Rishon ba'argo, first one first, and then he weaves it. Ain mitzareif. They're not mitzareif. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, Omer Mishin Rabbi Shimon, tzivao mitzareif. If he dyed it, he is mitzareif. So you see over here, according to Rabbi Shimon, dyeing it is not considered a shinoi. Yet, we're saying that libun is considered to be a shinoi. So now, the truth is, it's not a question on anybody's opinion, it's a problem in the braita. One braita says Rabbi Shimon thinks that libun is a shinoi. The other braita says that tzivao is not a shinoi. For Rova, who differentiate even within the sheet of Rabbi Shimon, you could ask from dying to dying. But either way, you can ask this question about the sheet of Rabbi Shimon because it appears in the two different braitot, and you have a problem here. So Rabbi Lokasha Rabbonon Alibi to Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon Yehuda Alibi Rabbi Shimon. Very simple answer over here. Rabbi Shimon is quoted in the name of Rabbi Shimon by Yehuda. So there are two different Tanaim quoting Rabbi Shimon. In one case, they think it is a shinoi. In one case, it's not a shinoi. We can differentiate. Rav Amar Lolam Lo Pligi Rabbanan Alei De Rabbi Shimon Bar Yehuda. No, the Rabbanan don't disagree with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yehuda. B'shayni tseva. Dying is different. Ho v'yochol haviro ayodei tzafon. You can remove it with soap. It's similar to the modern day word sabon. You can remove it with soap. So since the dying is reversible, that's not called a shinoi, because dying is something that you could undo. Now, what about the fact that we had a brayta before which says that if you didn't give it to him yet, but he dyed it, and when he dyed it, you are patur. And over there you said that's even according to Rabbi Shimon. Now, how are you going to explain that? Now you're telling me that colors can be undone. Well, if colors can be undone, then there isn't a shinoi. The answer is, b'kala ilan, delo avar. There's certain dyes that cannot be removed. Kala ilan is a classic example. It was a fake tchelet. It was a color that looked very similar to tchelet. The Gemara speaks about it all the time, about people who used to sell it as a fake for tchelet, and there are tests to tell whether the tchelet or kala ilan. It's a very complex test that is done with different chemicals by which tchelet would not be removed, and Kala Ilan would be removed. So there is a way to remove Kala Ilan, but it's very complex. It's not an easy way to do it. And therefore, Kala Ilan is seen to be as a permanent dye versus other coloring, which is not a permanent dye. So then Tosafot over here asks, if that's the case, then why didn't the Gemara, instead of differentiating between Seva and Libun, make a distinction internally within Tzvia? Say Tzvia that is reversible versus Tzvia that is irreversible. That should be a distinction within Rabbi Shimon's opinion. Why did Rova say no? The difference between Libun, whether he did it by combing or by hand, he could have made a difference in saying that it has to do with whether he dyed it with a permanent dye or he didn't dye it with a permanent dye. So Tosafot says over here, the Rova, the Rabbi Shimon, Adif Libun, to lo hadar mitzeva. Libon is better because it doesn't reverse. And then Seva, which does reverse. Rabbanan adif lo tseva avagav dahadra. Even though it goes back, the fishu shinui meruba. The libon shu shinui buat avagav dlo hadar. So what Tosfot in the end says, this is the difference between Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim as to why they think certain things are shinuim. Which is that when it comes to coloring, it's a much more significant change in the wool, even though it's reversible. And therefore, according to Rava, the Rabbanan think that Sivao is a shinoi, and Libno is not a shinoi. On the other hand, when it comes to Rabbi Shimon says Libun is a more significant change because it's irreversible. Whereas Tseva is not such a significant change because it is reversible. And so their argument revolves around what's a more significant shinoi. According to Rabbi Shimon, a more significant shinoi is something that is irreversible. But according to the Chachamim, a more significant shinoi is something that is more visible, more obvious that there was a shinoi in the object, even if it is reversible. All right, so now, just to summarize how you would explain this Gemara, according to Rabbi and according to Rava, in the case, the Brayta Rishona, which says, the Tzemer Belibno, which is a shinoi, according to Abaye, that's Rabbi Shimon offered that position. The second Brayta that says, Libno Velo Tzivao, that shinoi is not koneh, that's the Rabbanon Shita. The Brayta that we brought over here, that Gazzo Tzivao Vargo, Rabbi Shimon says there that shinoi is koneh, Libno, that's Rabbi Shimon. Libno Rabbanon Shinoi Lo Koneh, that's the Rabbanon. Now, Tzivao, if you dyed it, Ha Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, that'd be the Rabbi Shimon. According to Baye, that's Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, according to Rabbi Shimon, and that's why it's not koneh. Libun, where it is koneh, that's Rabbanon aliba de Rabbi Shimon. Now, Rava's explanation of the Gemara is, the case of Tzemer v'libno, which you are chayav for, is saruke saruke, is that we combed it with a utensil, according to the alternative view, which is b'chia b'avin. Not like Tosafot, but like Rashi, is kavre kuvure, where he did it with a chemical. The case of livno velo tzivo, where it's not, lo yispik leno ad shetzivo patur, shinoi koneh, there that the color is a shinoi koneh, but libon is not a shinoi koneh, that's the case of Rabbi Shimon again, but that's not saying nifutze, it's a case where he either combed it by hand, or chavre chavure, or he washed it, and that's why it, the case of the braita that says, gazzo tovo argo, that Rabbi Shimon says shinoi koneh, that's a libon de Rabbi Shimon. Livno Rabbanan Shinoi Lo Koneh, that is the Rabbanan Shita. Now, the case of Tzivao, where Rabbi Shimon says Shinoi Eino Koneh, that Shani Tzeva, because you can remove it. It's reversible. The case of Libun, Rabbi Shimon says Shinoi Koneh, that's because it's Lo Choser, it's irreversible. And the Braita that says that Tzivao is Patur, that Shinoi is Koneh, that's the case where you use the dye of Kala Ilan, that was a dye that is irreversible. So that's a summary of how do you explain all the different brightot according to Abaye and Rava. Now Amar Abaye will begin this sugi, we won't be able to finish it today. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, Beit Shammai, Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, Rabbi Shmuel kulu sfirlo, all of them hold shinui b'mkomo made. When a change happens, a change is not significant enough to change the item from being its an original state. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda had Amran. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda we just said, because Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda says the name Rabbi Shimon, when you dye it, that's not considered to be a shinoi. Now, the Baal Tosfot point out here, and they do this many places in Shas, whenever the Gemara says, kulu sfirlo, doesn't mean that they all have the exact same opinion. It means that they have the same genre of opinion. That's because even Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda only argues on tzivao. He only is about dyeing. But he says, argo, if you weaved it, or tzivao, if you spun it, that would be a shinoi, and that would not be the original item, and you'd pay kashat gzelo there. So Rabbi Shimon Yehuda's opinion is only in a case of dying. It's only a particular case. Whereas the other Tanaim that we're going to bring over here say shinoi doesn't work, period. So Tosfot says it just means they have the same type of shita that sometimes shinoi doesn't work. But not that they really have the exact same shita. That's the way the Baal Tosafot say it. There are other Rishonim, I think the Rashba over here, who suggests that when Rabbi Shimon Yehuda said Tzivao, he means Tzivao and all the other items as well. I mean, that's really his opinion. And then when the Gemara says here, the Kulan Sfirlu, it means they all have the exact same Shita. Right, so now, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda we saw. Now again, Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, we also saw earlier in the Masechta. Mai, the Tanya, we saw that back in Daf Samechei. Not on Achiti Met Nana. He pays a Zonah for consorting with her. He pays her wheat. Vasan Solit, and she makes them into fine flour. Zaitim, he pays her olives. Vasan Shemen, and he makes them into oil. Anavim, he gives her grapes, and she presses them into wine. Tani chada asur, but tani idach mutar. One braita says that it's a sur to put it on the mizbeach. It's still considered to be etnan zonah, the payment for the services of a harlot. Tanidach mutar, that it's mutar, it's no longer considered to be etnan zonah. Rav Yosef tani gurion de mi ispork. So Rav Yosef, who brings from gurion to be asporkeg, bet shemai usrim, bet hillel matirim. The machloket here is between bet hillel and bet shemai. The difference in the braitot is the difference between bet shemai and bet hillel. That is my time at the bet shemai. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shammai's opinion? Amar Kra, Gam Shnehem. To say both of them may not go on the Mizbeach, both of them over there is Etnan Zonah and Mechir Kelev. The payments for the services of a Zonah and something that was exchanged for a dog. Gam Shnehem, both of them may not be on the Mizbeach. There are both Shinuyem. Gam Shnehem, the Gam is a Reboy, and Beit Shammai says that Reboy comes to tell you not only are those items, but any derivative of those items may not end up on the Mizbeach, even there is a Shinoi. B'tel Amar Kra, Haim, V'lo Shinoiam. Only them are problematic, not things that are derivatives or changes of them. Beit Shammai, Aktiv, Haim. What are they going to do with the word Haim? Ha'o Mibayle, Haim, V'lo V'laduteyam. They may not end up on the Mizbeach, but their offspring can go on the Mizbeach. U'Beit Hillel, Tarte, Shmat, Mina. They learn both of those out of the word Haim. Haim, V'lo Shinoiam, Haim, V'lo V'laduteyam. It's the same limud. It means only the item itself is problematic, not a derivative. Derivative can be in two ways. It can be something that comes from this item, or it can be an offspring of this item. Those are both derivatives, and they are not subject to the din of Etnan Zonah or Mechir Kelev. B'tel Nami Aktiv Gam. What about the word Gam for Beit Hillel? What are they going to be Merabe for the word Gam? Gam the Beit Hillel Kasho. Gam for Beit Hillel is a problem. It's an extraneous word, and they have no limud for the word Gam. Beit Shammai uses it to teach you Gam, meaning that the shinuyehem, any changed item, derivative, changed item from it, is still considered to be etnan zonah. Beit Hillel disagrees with their conclusion, but doesn't have anything to do with the word gam. The Rabbi Akiva Eiger points you back to Daf Nun Dalet, there where the Gemara quotes other places in Shas, where we have an extraneous word and we don't know what to do with it. Back there, the Gemara was discussing extra word chamor for Rabbi Yehuda, who thinks that you are chayav for those items in the boar. What does he do with the extra word chamor? And said by Aveda, which we'll see in the Gemara Beit Mitzir, are extra. Tosfot over there asks, why doesn't the Gemara also bring the Beit Shammai case? That's another word where we don't have a drasha for it. So Tosfot over says, there they're only talking about Balei Chaim. They're only talking about livestock, where we don't have a drasha for the word. Over here, it's just the word Gam, so that's why it's not included in the list there. But truthfully, there is another case, by Gam the Beit Hillel, but we don't have a drasha for the word. Okay, we're going to stop over here, 8 lines down on the top of Tzadi Dalet Amud Aleph, and we'll continue with the other Tanaim tomorrow to see their opinions with regards to Shinoi Bimkomo Omeid.